Welcome to In Tune with Opera Philadelphia. I'm Mike Bolton. Today, we're going to listen to a conversation that I had with composer Philip Venables. He is part of the dynamic duo of Philip Venables and Ted Huffman, who are behind such revelatory new operatic works. The previous piece, 448 Psychosis, has had sterling reviews, and their new piece, Denis and Katya, is a highlight of Opera Philadelphia's 019. Even before it hit the stage, it was the winner of the Fedora Generali Prize for Opera in 2019. Now that the opera has had its world premiere, the critics are weighing in, and they're all extremely enthusiastic about the piece. The New York Times called it an intimate and haunting triumph. Musical America said not only is Venables' newest creation the most brilliantly original operatic work I've seen in a decade, it's a sensitive, subtle, and deeply questioning meditation on youth, voyeurism, and the age of social media. And the Philadelphia Inquirer said, highly experimental in its manner, the piece exudes great confidence of purpose plus gritty, thoughtful artistry in the spirit of 019's commitment to making opera a distinctly 21st century thing. It was my honor to sit down with Mr. Venables for a spectacular conversation. One of the nicest fellows you would ever want to meet, but also so insightful and fascinating to talk to him about his work and his process, the creation of Denis and Katya, social media use, and more. Here's our conversation. Venables, the composer for Denis and Katya, here to talk about this fascinating new work that is part of our 019 festival, and really one of the things that we're most excited about. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Delighted.
You just came from a rehearsal?
I've just came from a recording session, actually, for some pre-recorded material for the opera.
Okay, how'd it go?
It went really well, like
great.
A dream.
And you've been here, gosh, we're recording on the 9th of September. You've been here, what, at least 2 weeks?
We've been here 3 weeks now.
3 weeks.
Yeah, and we open in 9 days.
How do you feel?
Touch wood, everything is going quite smoothly. We've got a lot of work ahead of us. We're just moving into the theatre today. So, now it finally comes together. So, it's exciting.
So tell me about this process. How long of a journey has this been for you guys?
We pitched it to David Duran at Opera Philadelphia about a year and a half ago, or maybe 2 years ago, actually. And then we got the green light last June. And so over the summer and into the autumn, we were doing lots of research because it's a very kind of research-based piece. And then we took a trip to Russia in November. And then in February, we had a week of workshops here, and in May, another week of workshops here, and here we are now a week away.
So Denis and Katya, can you tell us a little bit about the historical aspect or the real life aspect of what the piece is about?
Yeah, the piece is a verbatim theatre piece, so it's based on interviews with people and other original text sources about two Russian teenagers who in November 2016 ran away from home and through various events ended up in a kind of stakeout, if you like, with the police. Now they both died. It's not quite totally clear how. And we don't try to answer that question in the opera. But whilst they were run away from home and hiding in a cabin for 3 days, they were live streaming on the internet as well. So we have these kind of parallel realities. We have this situation of them in a cabin surrounded by police, and then we have this other reality of them talking to friends online and also strangers from all over the place online as this was happening.
Who came up with the idea to turn this into an opera?
Well, so first of all, the only reason that we found out about this story is because the BBC and the Daily Mail and other international press covered it afterwards. It was a very big story in Russia shortly afterwards. There was TV talk shows about it, and it was a bit of a scandal, of course. But it appeared, a link to one of the articles appeared in Ted's Facebook newsfeed. And he sent it to me and said, wow, you should check this out. It's a really compelling story. And of course, we weren't necessarily looking for ideas for a particular project, but we were in a phase. We just finished 448 Psychosis, which was our last opera, and we were kind of just in this phase of brainstorming and having ideas and just being generally excited about potential things. And so I checked it out, and we just talked about it more, just kind of without really taking it that seriously. But then these conversations developed, and we realized it would make a really, really great subject matter for us, for the kind of opera work that we wanted to do. So then we came and pitched it here.
What got you excited about the story?
Well,
and particularly setting it to as an opera?
Well, we wanted to make a very small scale piece. We also had been working on various small projects, which were verbatim or using original text from the internet, like kind of hate speech from social media or such like. So, and we were very interested in lots of text layers, which we'd also taken from previous work. So they were the kind of things that we were interested in. And this story, as well as being a very compelling story, with all of these kind of different layers of material, we thought we could, you know, that would be a good material for as a vehicle for the kinds of ways in which we want to tell stories in opera.
And when you say text layering, what do you mean by that?
So the opera is not just sung; it's partly spoken. Some of the text is projected, etc., etc. There is also pre-recorded text. These are all things that we've done in previous work and you know want to keep working with, because I find that interface between those different text modes, if you like, really interesting.
So in this case, you might be doing a video projection of a text conversation or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. So one thread in the opera is actually a series of conversations that Ted and I had on WhatsApp. So you see our WhatsApp messages projected in kind of rhythmic synchronization with music onto the set.
So as a composer, how do you set that to music?
Well, it's literally like one word per note, usually. And we're doing that with electronic music. I mean, we also have four cellos on stage, but that layer of WhatsApp text is very clearly delineated from the characters that our performers play. It's like this kind of meta layer that sits kind of intermittently above the rest of the opera, if you like.
So it's its own sound world, in a
yes,
way.
Yes, yeah, it is, yeah.
So you have four cellos.
We have four cellos and a mezzo-soprano and a baritone. Yeah, two performers, four cellos.
How do you... you took part in the conversation that we had at the Kimmel Center yesterday as part of our Between the Notes series. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, as I've been thinking through this whole process, how do you create color with four of the same instrument?
Well, a cello is a very versatile instrument and can make a big sound. It's one of the biggest string instruments. So four cellos is... can be actually quite a formidable force. It's also an amplified opera, so both the singers and the cellists are all amplified and mixed with recorded sound as well. There's lots of different kind of playing techniques we use. They're also spatialized in the four corners of the stage. So not only is it about different kind of tone color with them, but also about spatialization left and right or back and front, or you know, kind of effectively like games of ping pong with musical material across the stage between cellists.
And you may not be able to answer this question, but so if you're sitting in the audience, are you going to be hearing like quadraphonic stereo sound in versus various corners, or?
Yes, certainly. I mean, we have surround sound in the theater, and there will be parts of the opera which will be sonically immersive. And we are splitting left and right. The left and right interplay is very important in the piece. We'll be working on that this week in the theatre, on exactly how the kind of sound is distributed to make sure that we get a really good, that it feels like natural acoustic music, but is somehow that you're in the middle of it rather than at some distance.
How did you start that journey? Because I would guess that if you're in conservatory, you don't really have the opportunity to play with that sort of compositional style and electronics like that. And how did you get involved in that, and what do you love about it?
I mean, I'm certainly no expert in the electronics, and we have a really, really great sound designer on this piece, Rob Kaplowitz, who is doing all of that magic. But I just like work that's very immersive. It is partly about volume in some ways, but this is not necessarily a very loud show. But it's more about being in it and not necessarily feeling that kind of distance that you can in a huge, I mean, of course, main stage opera. You can be a huge distance away from the stage. I think if you're also using projection and if you're using any kind of synthetic sound or pre-recorded sound, then you want to mix that in properly as well. So you need to kind of create this like sound space in order to do that, which includes, you know, amplifying the live instruments as well.
So as the composer, how do your performers react to that? You know, because it's very, and then on top of it, they have a click track. It's not what they're used to.
No, I mean, the amplification, I mean, for the cellists is, you know, most players these days have played session work and are used to playing with microphones. And to be honest, I think with instrumentalists, it doesn't actually really change the way that you play very much. It does mean that you can just play as quietly as possible and we're still going to hear it. The click tracks, of course, something that not everybody is used to.
Pardon me, I should interrupt 1 second. What is a click track?
Oh yeah, so we should back up and say that this piece is not being done with a conductor. Well, actually, a step before that even. The way that Ted and I wanted to tell this story is like a TV documentary, in that it's kind of a series of talking heads with six different characters. And these, we cut very, very quickly between these different characters, just like you might see in a kind of TV documentary or something. Which means that within the first, well, roughly the first 35 minutes of the piece, there are 115 or something, 112 micro scenes, some of which last 8 seconds or less. To make opera in that way, with this kind of very, very precise spontaneity and synchronization, you couldn't really do that with a conductor. So we had to look for other tools to be able to do this. And what we've decided is to, every performer is hooked up to a kind of in-ear cueing system. So they're getting a click track, which is kind of like a metronome, a pulse in their ear to keep them in time. They're getting text cues, they're getting pitches so that they can kind of start singing with no pitch from the orchestra. They're even getting kind of some staging instructions. I mean, it's an incredibly powerful tool. Of course, the challenge is to keep a space for musicality and for freedom within that, which we're managing to do. So we're using that, and that's quite an adaptation for the singers. It means that one of their ears is partially blocked, which is, you know, quite an adaptation when you're singing. But they have taken to it really, really well. And through the process, we've really been able to, and the workshop process as well, been able to refine what we put in their ears, and to find the things, to explore the kind of things that we can only do with that system that wouldn't otherwise be possible. So to try and kind of capture the power of it, really. I mean, the only reason that we're using this system is actually to give us incredible freedom on stage. There is no point that the singers are surrounded by these four cellos, and we've created this kind of playing space. And the whole first part of a piece, or really the whole piece actually, is meant to feel like a kind of spontaneous group act of theatre making. There's no conductor, there's no monitor, there's no monitors either. The players and the singers have only each other to communicate with. And that actually is a wonderful, wonderful feeling when you're staging something, and very unusual for opera. So whilst we have this kind of technology in the background that one could think is very inhuman and a bit robotic and stuff, the point of it is to give us more spontaneity and more freedom on stage.
But it's like getting it into your system so that you're okay with it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, my hope is that it's completely irrelevant for the audience how it's done. You know, it's like a magician explaining how they do their tricks.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, it's interesting, really, really interesting for us as making the piece and exploring this technology. But for the audience, I of course, we're not trying to hide the earpieces or anything like that. They'll know, but it's not a piece about the technology in that sense. And I just hope that it gives this kind of precision spontaneity that's really virtuosic and really, really exciting to watch and to listen to.
But there's almost like there's almost this inevitability that you have to have this much technology about a piece that deals with technology and social media.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can totally draw that parallel. And I think Ted is fond of that kind of connection. I mean, for me, it's more about finding the tools. This piece, for me, is very much about storytelling and about the way in which we tell stories. And the way that all of these six characters looking in as voyeurs, as Ted and I are, so eight characters if you include Ted and I in these WhatsApp conversations, how we're all looking in on these two teenagers who never appear in the opera. They're only talked about in the third person. And it's about how we tell those stories and about finding interesting ways to tell them, and therefore the tools that you need technically to tell stories in that way.
Voyeur is a word that I've used a couple times to describe the piece.
Yeah.
And every time I use it, everyone sort of, you know, their heads cock and they're like, oh, well, they get uncomfortable with the word. But then, and you know, there's a not a stigma, but we affiliate voyeurism with sex.
Yeah.
Even though this doesn't necessarily have a sexual connotation.
No.
But we are still, as audience members, we're as much voyeurs into the piece as we are immersed in it in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the internet particularly is, as we live in the internet and society kind of evolves with the internet and social media, voyeurism is not just a sexual thing. I mean, we have essentially clickbait, which covers essentially kind of war porn, poverty porn, you know, voyeurism, suffering of all sorts of things. The grimmest things make the best clickbait in some ways, which is horrific. But that's something that, you know, we should acknowledge and talk about.
Yeah.
And really, that's one of the things that this piece is about.
In preparing for this, you guys did a lot of homework. You went to Russia.
Yeah.
You met with a friend of Denise's.
Mm-hmm.
How did that trip to Russia help inform the process, or maybe give it a realism or a reality that maybe had not been there previously?
Well, so four of us went to Russia. I did, and then Ted Huffman, the director, and Ksenia Ravina, the dramaturg and co-creator, and Pierre Martin, the video designer. So the four of us went We spent 3 days in St. Petersburg and then 3 days in Pskov, which is the city that that Denise and Katya were from. And then we made a day trip to Strugi Krasnia, which is the village where the hunting cabin was, where this happened. It was very, very useful for many different reasons, that trip. For Pierre, of course, obviously, he took lots of video footage, some of which appears in the show. We made sound recordings as well, which also are used in the show. So we collected a lot of material for the production, as it were. Ted had been having Skype interviews with a journalist who investigated the story in quite some detail after the events. And so we met her in St. Petersburg on that trip as well and talked to her more, which was really interesting. And then, yes, Ksenia had been meeting up with the best friend of Denise quite a number of times. Sadly, we didn't get to meet him, but the interviews, the material that we got from him have been used in the show. And then on another level, it was more the kind of vague, like, inspiration aspect, where just kind of seeing the landscape, seeing the city where they were, kind of talking to the woman who runs the cafe, the only cafe in the village where this happened, and other such things like that, really. Just more of a general going to the mall where the kids would hang out, etc. was interesting, and it's hard to put your finger on how that learning experience has changed, you know, this bar of music or that line of text or whatever. You can't, but it really immersed us in the story and in the place, and I think that was really important. And of course the other thing was that we had like an intense week together. It was like boot camp for the show,
and you had no time to put this thing together.
I mean, yeah, exactly. Which is why, like, being in Russia for a week together with, you know, outside of our daily lives with no distractions, it was like, kind of, what do you call it, like, so housing or something.
It's been a year, more or less, of composition?
It's been less than that, really, because there was so much research required to get text up and running, and so we didn't really have... I didn't really start composing until when we got back from Russia at the end of November last year, because that was the first time that we actually, on that trip, we managed to get a concept for this storytelling, for the form. And we had a lot of text material already for quite a while before that, but we had not decided what we were going to do with it, basically, how it was going to be used. So.
And in comparison, how long did it take to write 448 Psychosis?
Well, that was also written very quickly in about 9 months, but I had spent a year pretty much living with that text. So it was, so in a sense it felt like that took 2 years to write, but the first year was I just did work on text. I didn't write any music, and actually I think that was a really good decision, because that text is a very different kind of text, and so dense with meaning, with unpicking dramaturgy that you have to kind of invent in a way. All sorts of decisions had to be made before I could start writing music.
So you're really looking for a day when you have a good 2 years to really just write music.
Well, actually, after this, I'm taking some time off writing music. So,
but that condensed timeline, was that exciting? Was it scary? Was it all of the above?
Well, of course it's exciting, because on one level, that much stress is always exciting, but it's not, it's a double-edged sword, put it that way. It's not how I think I would like to work, because of course it is exciting and you do have a lot to do and you have to get it done and you have to make ideas under pressure, but it's very, very anxious the way that you know that you have very little time to correct massive failures. And I think this has gone very well, and we really have found a really, really good way to make the piece. But if we'd got stuck any more, then it would have got into really choppy waters.
So I have to share with you, I was having a conversation with Sarah Williams, who's our New Works Administrator, earlier today, and she's gushing about you and the team and how much she respects and admires your work and how excited she is by it. And then she said the one thing that always comes through with you is that you're committed to your vision, and your vision of what you want to do artistically is so clear. How would you describe your vision?
That's a hard question. Well, that's very nice of her to say, and it's nice to think that other people feel that, because it doesn't always feel like that from the inside, although, you know, I know that as a team we care a lot, and we do kind of share aesthetics and like what we want to do. We're all on the same page in that, and that's why it's a really lovely team to work with. With Ted and I, we've had, our vision is, I think, to make immersive work that crosses the boundaries between opera and spoken theatre, and that finds new ways to tell stories, that gets away from the kind of traditional bond between character and performer that is, you know, in a kind of character narrative dramatization, which is the majority of opera. So it's trying to break that bond, trying to think about having performers on stage as performers rather than as characters, which is true in this piece, for example. Trying to layer text in opera, to increase kind of text comprehension in opera is another big kind of passion of mine. All these things. Ted and I as well, we're both very excited by going to the theatre. I mean, Ted is an opera director, he only works in opera, and I'm mainly writing opera, so that's our field, but we go to the theatre a lot, and it's interesting to, you know, to try and take ideas from that.
So if you look at maybe the canon of opera,
yeah,
what inspires you, or doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it does. I mean, I love lyric singing, and I think a lot of people have asked me, is this an opera, you know, etc., etc., what is an opera, all of those questions, which don't really matter to me that much. I love lyric singing. There's lots of lyric singing in this piece. Yes, there's lots of spoken text as well, but I love going to the opera, and you know, I love some classics like Madame Butterfly, like Elektra, Strauss, I love Shostakovich, Ligeti, all sorts of things. You take different inspiration for different ideas from different pieces.
What are your social media habits?
Well, at the moment, I feel like my Facebook usage has got worse and worse, which is probably not what should be happening whilst making a show about how evil social media can be. But I tend to use Facebook primarily, and then sometimes Twitter. I've never used Snapchat because I'm too old, and I don't really use Instagram because I'm not the kind of person who takes a lot of photos.
Have there been situations where people have been critical of your work on social media, and what do you do with it?
Yes, I have. I have even had people on a dating app just write to me completely out of the blue by recognizing me and telling me that, yeah, giving me tips for how I could have improved my last opera, and I didn't even say hello to them.
So that means the date is out of the question.
I didn't meet that person. but other than that, no. I mean, yeah, no. Social media. I haven't personally experienced the dark side of social media.
Yesterday in the conversation, I guess somebody talked about how you guys have all reached out to the family, and Katja's family didn't really respond. But
We didn't reach out to Katja's family because they left town, and nobody had any. There was no way of contacting them.
Yeah.
We reached out to Denise's mother.
And how did she react?
This was through Ksenia, and Ted wrote a letter. Ted and Ksenia wrote a letter to her, basically, that was delivered to her, so we are told, via the best friend of Denise. And the best friend of Denise came back to us and said that she reacted positively, and that's all that he said, and all that we know
in the press, when it first happened back in 2016, there was a lot of talk about Romeo and Juliet and that kind of thing. How do you feel about that phrase, Romeo and Juliet, and as tied to this piece?
Yeah, it doesn't... it's... I think it can be a bit distracting, but of course it is a useful touchstone. And of course, and at one point we were thinking of making the parallels between the stories much more a big part of the piece. But we ended up kind of moving away from that. Calling the story, giving it that kind of name is another aspect of the kind of sensationalization that, you know, that we're talking about that happens on the internet. I think this Romeo and Juliet reference was actually in the original headline of the link that appeared in Ted's newsfeed, which is probably why we think he got it in his algorithms, because he had recently been staging Shakespeare. So his Google had been full of a lot of Shakespeare, and he was getting stuff in his Facebook newsfeed, and this reference Romeo and Juliet, therefore that's why it appeared, we think, because no one ever knows.
So one of the things that we are most excited about here at Opera Philadelphia is that Denis Nkacha, the commission, won the Fedora Generale Prize, a huge European award that an American company got. Tell us a little bit about
that. Yeah, it's the first time that an American company has got that. It's quite a new prize, which I think this is the fifth year that it's been running, and it awards €150,000 to a production of a new work which hasn't yet been staged but will be staged within the next 12 months or something. It is only awarded to kind of networks of partnerships as well. So in this case, Opera Philadelphia as the kind of primary commissioner, and Music Theatre Wales and the Opera in Montpellier. Okay. As the other commissioners, and it's a competitive thing.
And while you were there, was there any sort of buzz from those who were attending about wanting to learn more or finding out about the European performances, or anybody that you came in contact with that got excited about it?
Of course, yeah. The prize is well known in Europe, and aside from the money in the production, which is great, the kind of profile that has given the show is going to encourage, for example, heads of opera houses or whatever, other people working in the industry to come and see the show or to find out more information or to think about taking it. It will really help develop new partnerships for the piece, I think, in the future.
Well, this is, you're absolutely delightful. this has been
this
a real
been
pleasure.
A lovely chat. Thank you.
Yeah.
A message saying she was with Dennis. Their lives were ruined. They had no way
out. You've been listening to a conversation with Philip Venables, the composer of the new extraordinarily received opera, Denis Nkacha. If you don't have your tickets yet for Denis Nkacha, the run ends on Sunday, September 29th. If you want more information, check out our website at operaphila.org. Also part of our O19 Festival, a cornucopia of works, other works we're doing, Prokofiev's The Love for Three Oranges in a production from Florence, Italy, and that is in the Academy of Music, also running through September 29th, and then Handel's Semele, in a production that we co-produced with Opera Omaha, and that is in the Perelman Theater within the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, and that runs through Saturday to September 28th. And then, as part of the Fringe Festival, we have Let Me Die. That is a world premiere from the mind of Joseph Koechler, and that is at the Fringe Arts Building with performances running through Saturday, September 28th. For information on all of these operas and our upcoming season, visit operaphila.org for all the information you could ever possibly want. If you have questions or comments about this podcast, you can email us at info@operaphila.org. Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm your host, Mike Bolton.